look at Islam and religious liberty. And just to remind you, we looked at government last week and then religious liberty this week. And then next week we'll begin in jihad, what it means according to the Quran and Hadith. And prayerfully, a whole lot of things that are confusing about that will become lucidly clear. And while we talk about this, and as we go through these over the next coming weeks, after we've really looked at this, you may want to go back and look at or listen to this morning's message on war with the understanding of what they really teach about government, religious freedom, and jihad. When we talked about Islam and government, Islam and national government are one in Islamic state. The idea of church and state, which is the idea that there is no national church, that's what the idea is, and that local communities could have a church that you had to belong to, even states at the time that the Constitution was adopted. But you could not have a national. There could not be a federal government. And if you read the First Amendment, that's why it says Congress, not your local government. So that is a Christian concept, not an Islamic concept. It actually makes no sense in Islam. Now, countries are of varying degrees of practicing Islam. And so this confuses people sometimes, or they tend to believe that, you know, you look at Turkey or somewhere like that, Saddam's regime is always said to be very secular, and it is in many ways. However, the undergirding ideas, what they fall back on, what they use or misuse, is Islam. The governments are to operate under the Sharia, which is what we looked at last time. It is a code of law based upon religious principles that are derived from the Quran and the Hadith, which are unchangeable. And then there is analogical reasoning, and there is consensus. And the consensus is sometimes of all of the people, but many times it becomes the consensus of a select group, the leaders, the royal family, etc. Those last two, analogical reasoning and consensus, can change, and therefore there is a little flexibility. My concern when we talk about this is, what happens to a state, a nation, when Islam comes in and they follow to a strict adherence of the Quran and the Hadith? And that's what we're focused on. You can have a state where there are Muslims, and maybe they don't exert a lot of pressure, and so someone may hold that up as a model. That is not my concern. My concern is for us to understand that if they do follow the Quran and the Hadith, what will it look like? If they were to come and to become so numerical and so numerous in America that America turned to becoming an Islamic government, it is not what it would look like if they did not follow the Quran or the Hadith strictly, but what if they did? So, Islam and government. Tonight, which we mentioned last time, we're going to look at Islam and religious liberty. America was founded upon the principle of religious freedom, not religious toleration. But it was religious freedom, and that's why the Constitution could not be passed until the Ten Amendments were put on it, and the one on religion, that the government, the federal government, Congress would not make a law, and the second clause sums it up, that would prohibit the free exercise thereof. It was not that we were established to tolerate religion, but it was we were established so that the free exercise of it would be unencumbered by the federal government. Now, we are a country that has an incredibly cumbersome political system, and this is not the time or place to go into that, but let me just state that you have the national and you have the three branches, but then we have the state, then we have the local areas, the municipalities, and so forth. And the restrictions on the prohibiting the free exercise were given to the Congress so that any community could reflect its moral and religious principles. And so you could move into an area that had all Mormons, and if that local state area wanted that to be the dominant place, they could. But the federal government could not make it so. The Constitution only gives 20 things that the federal government can do. They are doing about 29,000 today. How is that? Through two things. One is bureaucracy. And what I mean by bureaucracy is this. It is that part of the federal government administration under the direction of the president that does not change from one president to the next. It is so massive that a president comes in and he has people in his bureaucracy who absolutely disagree with him being president, and yet he's supposed to direct them. There are so many layers. But the most important way is through the welfare system. We are becoming more and more of a welfare nation. And what I mean by this is they tax us, and there's federal taxation, and it is so much that now the federal government sends some of it back to states and local municipalities. When they send it back, they are able to exercise authority that the Constitution never granted them. So let's just take Norman High and Norman North. And each of them are getting $5 million a year through taxes that left the state, went to the federal government. Now it comes back because they're implementing certain programs or following certain guidelines. One of them decides that they want to really do what the community says, and the community doesn't want that anymore. And the federal government says, well, you do have a right to do that because you're a local school. However, you will lose the $5 million. And then we're going to hold that school to competing with the other school that has $5 million more. And that's how they're able to control. This happens with state highways. It happens with schools. It happens with everything. So the federal government has been so expanded that it confuses the issue of how we were founded. We were founded with the local morality and religious ideas could be expressed, and that was not a violation of church and state. What was a violation is if Congress passed laws that prohibited the free exercise of religion, either by prohibiting it or making a church a national religion that everybody had to belong to. So, the free exercise. Since the 7th century, and the pack of Umar, and Umar was the second caliph. He was the father-in-law to Muhammad, and he is known historically for spreading Islam through conquest. And Umar, as the caliph, made a pact, and it explained the principle in which they would operate. And I'm going to give you some of the ideas, but the principle to contrast with our First Amendment to not prohibit the free exercise, here is their principle which all Islamic governments are to follow in the case of religious freedom. Here it is, quote, that other faiths must be given no encouragement or opportunity to share, end quote. And that is a part of the Pact of Umar, and it has been since the 7th century what they have followed. Let me read you some things out of that pact. Quote, they shall not build in our cities or in their neighborhood new monasteries, churches, covenants, or monk cells, nor shall they repair by day or by night such of them as fall in ruins or are situated in the quarters of the Muslims, end quote. So you cannot build new churches. You cannot repair them, even if you do it when nobody's watching at night. And what this means is they move in and they take over, and there are churches there. You cannot build any new ones, and you can't repair that one, and eventually it will fall apart and you'll have no place to meet. A second one is, They shall not manifest religion publicly. Now that's talking about anybody that's not Islamic. Nor convert anyone to it. And speaking of Christians, shall not prevent any kin from entering Islam if they wish it, end quote. So we cannot manifest our religion publicly, we cannot convert a Muslim to it, and we cannot stop a family member from becoming a Muslim. Another one. They shall show respect towards the Muslims and shall rise from seats when Muslims wish to sit, end quote. So when you live in an Islamic society and you are not a Muslim, you are moved to a lower tier. Now, understand the pressure that you're beginning to see build when they say, yes, we don't force Christians and Jews, and we'll see more about that in a moment, but understand the pressure that you are living there, and when a Muslim comes in, you're supposed to get up and give your seat. Do you see how you're being lowered a tier, and then the societal pressure to convert? Another one in the Pact of Umar says, they shall not display crosses or books in the roads or markets of the Muslims. They shall use only clappers, and that's sticks that hit together, in churches very softly, end quote. That's what they mean, religious freedom. Under Islam, when a land is conquered, all were made to accept Islam or be killed, with the exception of Christians and Jews, and we are known as the protected people. However, being protected meant that we could remain Christian, remain Jew, we did not have to become them, but we had to operate under the Pact of Umar. We could not spread it, we could not convert, we could not repair our churches, we could not build new ones. We paid extra taxes for this protection. So when you have it, you are taxed extra, more than a Muslim, could not hold official offices, and could not live in certain places like Medina and Mecca. Could not witness or present our faith publicly. Now the social pecking order in an Islamic state is this. It is, of course, if they have any kind of royalty like Saudi Arabia. But other than that, it is Arabian Muslims, they're at the top, neo-Muslims, those that have converted, then below that are the protected, below that are slaves, and below that are prisoners of war. So as Christians, we would be below the Arabian Muslims and the neo-Muslims. The Quran in Surah 9:29 says this, fight those who do not believe in Allah, nor in the latter day, nor do they prohibit what Allah and His apostle have prohibited, nor follow the religion of truth, out of who have been given the book, which is us, the book, until they pay tax in acknowledgement of superiority and they are in a state of subjection, end quote. The people of the book pay the tax, which is an acknowledgement of subjection and inferiority to Islam. So actually, apart from all of the apologist propaganda, they don't love the people of the book. Because if we don't pay our tax, we are enemies. And if we do pay our tax, we are third-class citizens. And don't begin feeling real safe. Surah 9:30 in the Quran says this, and the Jews say, Ezra is the son of Allah. And the Christians say, the Messiah is the son of Allah. These are the words of their mouths. They imitate the saying of those who disbelieved before. May Allah destroy them. How they are turned away. End quote. So the Jews and the Christians pay a tax And that tax is in the mission of inferiority and subjugation to Islam, either second or third class citizens. According to Jacques Jomar in How to Understand Islam, he says, quote, "In the Middle Ages, those under protection were discriminated against. They wore clothing of a special color, could not ride horses. Measures which were applied more or less strictly depending on the time and the place." You remember the Jews in the Third Reich, they wore the band that showed they were Jews. That is the idea. The author goes on to quote a fundamentalist Islamic leader who said, quote, "that those under protection must not be entrusted with posts of leadership which rightly belong to Muslims," end quote. In other words, there are certain offices that you would not be able to hold. You see, again, the societal pressure that if you're wanting to move up the ladder, then there would be great incentive to become a Muslim. He says, despite everything there is a latent tendency in this direction. Now, let me give you a few countries, a few Islamic countries. Turkey, strong Muslim nation. We talk about it being secular, and I've told you there are some that are observing that as the leading group becomes more representative and you have more of the people that are Islamic, the leaders are becoming more in direction of Islam and not secular. Paul Marshall, in his book about Christian martyrs in modern times, Their Blood Cries Out, he says of the ecumenical patriarch Bartholomew I, who is the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church, and he is in Turkey. He says, quote, "The patriarch has been rigidly controlled, consistently denied permission to develop theological education or buildings for the Orthodox minority," end quote. When you use the term secular in an Islamic state, it does not mean religious freedom. Between 1905 and 1918 in Turkey, 2 million Armenian, and that is Armenian, not Armenian, Christians were slaughtered by the Ottomans. From 1905 to 1918, 2 million for their Christian faith. 1994 and 1996, explosives were used on attacks on Christian churches. Turkey. Morocco allows freedom of worship, but proselytizing is forbidden. Zamamda Mustaf was given a 3-year sentence for passing out Christian literature. Others were imprisoned for not participating in Ramadan. Christians who openly worship Christ and serve Him may be killed or imprisoned. They are forced out of work or they are forced to convert to Islam. Christian centers, which we would call churches, are destroyed in Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Turkmenistan, Pakistan, Uzbekistan, and the list goes on. And what I want you to see is we are not talking about a fringe group, be it Al-Qaeda or someone else. What the list I just gave you represents hundreds of millions of Muslims. In Sudan, Muslims came to power in 1983. It became an Islamic place. They immediately declared jihad on millions of the infidels. We call them Christians. The result of that declaration of jihad is described in Kaner's book, Unveiling Islam, and he says this. Between 1 and 3 million had been killed by January 2002. More Sudanese have become victims than in Rwanda, Bosnia, Somalia, and Kosovo combined. The gravity of that, beloved, is a Holocaust that has gone on in our lifetime against Christians. 50,000 children of the Dinka tribe are held slaves right now. Their families can buy them back with a cow or $15 if they can get it. Forced conversion to Islam is government policy. Open preaching and evangelizing is illegal and punishable by imprisonment or beating. Paul Marshall, again in his book, The Blood Cries Out, describes the scene in the Nuba Mountains, which is south central Sudan, and he says, and I quote, "Mass graves hold the remains of entire villages. In internment camps, where women and children are kept, Nuba women are systematically raped by Arab soldiers to produce non-Nuba offspring, and some report that Christians have been crucified by soldiers," end quote. That's what they mean by the term religious freedom. On February the 23rd, 2002, I was watching Alan Keyes' show Making Sense, and Chum Horan, who is the former U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, and this is what he said about Saudi. Quote, "Saudi Arabia practices Islam more strictly than anywhere else, but put on charm campaign to persuade us not to pay attention to what we see." End quote. He calls that the charm offensive. And what he means by that, and he went on to elaborate that Islamic countries do this, and Saudi particularly, is that they say things that are supportive of Western ideas, and they say them frequently and over, so that it will cause us to believe that rather than what we see with our own eyes. And I see this principle at work in Palestine with Israel and Arafat, who knows how to talk to the Western media, and we know that he says things in their native tongue that is very different from what he said to us. So they're able to say things that are supportive of Western ideas, say them loud enough and often enough to blind us to what we see, which actually contradicts. So what I'm telling you the Quran says, and what I'm telling you they're doing in country after country after country after country where Islam is dominant, this thing that he calls the charm offense, is when they're on television or they're meeting with the president or they're talking about Western ideas or religious freedom or progress, but in reality it's not what they're doing, you see. When I was doing this study on October the 18th, 2002, I have 2001, but I think it was later than that, I asked Anita to call the International Mission Board and to see what Muslim countries we could go into as missionaries. Their response was Pakistan and Bangladesh that allow Christian missionaries. And the other countries, missionaries go in to do other duties and try to share their faith while they're there. And they said, the IMB told us, generally speaking, all Muslim countries are closed to Christian missionaries, end quote. As I told you at the beginning of this study, I began believing that they were not really the way I am describing. And as I studied and began being faced with this relentless and seemingly ubiquitous message, I tried to make sure that I wasn't becoming imbalanced and just a Christian trying to show somebody else wrong. And that's why I had Anita. I said, well, if somebody's going to know, it's going to be the IMB. Well, the other day I did the same thing, and this was March the 17th of this year. And I asked Anita to call the IMB, and I asked her to ask, where can we freely share our faith in Islamic countries around the world. Which Islamic countries can we freely share our faith? Here's the answer. There are no Islamic countries where we can freely share the gospel. It is against the law, end quote. This is an undeniable reality that is confirmed by the Quran, the Hadith, 1,300 years of history, which we will get into with the jihad, present-day operating of Muslim country after Muslim country, particularly when they come in power, and our own International Mission Board that would know more about this than anybody in the world, in my estimation. Muslims come to America. There are different estimates, but I think the most accurate estimate is around, at most, 6 to 7 million. Some of their apologists try to make it more, some try to make it less, and so I'm just thinking that that's somewhere generally around the right estimation. But they are growing, and they are evangelizing, and they are trying to get it taught in schools, and they are using our laws to be able to propagate the freedom of religion in America, to propagate their religion. I ask myself, if they grow to a majority in America, will America remain open to all religions? They are a minority now. But if they become the majority in America, will they be consistent with the other lands where Muslims are the majority? Islam can express itself in a variety of governments, republics. It can be republic, it can be a blending of the secular, the sacred, it can be a monarchy. And this confuses people because one of them has a royal family like Saudi and some of them are more democratic, and then you have a dictatorship like Saddam and so forth. And so people are looking at it thinking, well, they're moving more in this direction. But the fact is, the Quran and the Hadith does not describe the type of government it has to be. It has to be Islamic, but the forms and the containers can vary, so they can adapt. The Ottoman Empire until the 1920s was a monolithic Islamic empire. Saudi has a stricter Islamic with a blend of secularism, and on it goes. But don't let that bring you to a place where you think, aha, Islam doesn't matter anymore. What has been true through all of those different governments and is true today is what I'm getting ready to share with you. It is what I kept running across, a we against them. We being Islam and them being everybody else. Islam views two states. In other words, they view the world with two possible states. So the democratic, monarchy, all of that, don't let that confuse you. These are the two states. The first is Dar al-Islam. D-A-R, and then the next word is A-L, and then the next word is Islam. Dar al-Islam. And this is the nation of believers at peace. Meaning it is an Islamic-controlled state. Dar al-Islam. The other state that they recognize is Dar al-Harb. D-A-R, and then the middle word is A-L again. But the last word is Harb. H-A-R-B. This is where the nation of unbelievers are at war. How does this arise, the Dar al-Harb? It arises, quote, the Islamic State is subjugated politically or economically by a non-Muslim nation, end quote. Let me read it again. The Islamic State is subjugated politically or economically by a non-Muslim nation. Our forces, when we get to jihad, you need to remember this. This is incredibly important. You're going to see when Osama laid out, or the five Taos laid out their fatwa, they gave three reasons. Because jihad has to be carried out only in a defensive mode, not an offensive mode. And so they have been able to lay it out defensively. And our presence in Saudi Arabia with our military, there at the most holy places, Mecca and Medina, close to them, is seen as subjugating an Islamic state. When we went into Somalia, when we went into Desert Storm, now being in Iraq, so that Iraq clearly sees it this way, many of the people. But when they keep talking about the Arab nations and what's going on, if you will, every time they say Arab, you say Islamic, and you will understand what is going on. The reason there is such an uproar among the Islamic people is because it is a state of Dar al-Harb, where the unbelievers are fighting and have come on Islamic soil. A Islamic state is being subjugated to a non-Islamic state. That is so critically important when you're listening to these things. They only see two states. And that is the two states. Dr. Braswell, as I told you, the distinguished professor of missions and world religion at Southeastern, he lived in Iran for 7 years. In his book, he says, the Muslim community has two choices when it comes to this situation of Dar al-Harb. They have two choices. There may be jihad to gain independence and reestablish the Islamic State, or there may be migration to another country, end quote. So there are two states, and according to their teaching, now you say, well, what if this one does this, and I heard a Muslim say this? We're not trying to deal with anecdotal things, what one Muslim says or another says. We're trying to deal with if they're faithful to their documents, their primary documents. They have two choices. One is jihad, and one is to move to another area. In 1980 in London, there was a gathering of worldwide Islamic leaders, and they issued a statement for the establishment of an Islamic order. It cited that only God confers authority on rulers, governments, and institutions, and that an Islamic government must follow the mandatory principles in the Quran and in their traditions. Now listen to this. This statement on the Islamic government, and it had to follow the Quran and traditions, which would be the Hadith. The statement emphasized brotherhood, justice, and consensus. You know what it did not emphasize anywhere in it? It never mentioned political freedom or individual liberty. We are dealing with a totally different worldview. I remember during the Cold War, and there are some people who really did some insightful studying and writing on this, and a man named Schwartz and others who spent much time among the communists. And one of the things that we have a problem doing, and I'm speaking just as Americans, I don't know about the rest of the world, but I know in general Americans, we have a view that some people really don't believe what they believe. We can't believe that a communist really believes that communism is really the best thing. So if we could just take them to school a couple of days and have them over at the house for watermelon, they'd see the light. And that's what we think. That's what some think today. If we can just get in there and talk to them, and if they could see what nice people we are, but they are coming from a devoted religious life, at least many of them. Dr. Braswell again says this, the enemies of God are those who threaten the existence of the Islamic community and peace, who persecute Muslims and the polytheists. Now, the polytheists are us. We are also seen as doing what? Persecuting the Muslims. If you watch what Saddam Hussein is doing in the media, the propaganda war, if you see any of that, if you can just think that what he's trying to do is not just show these things happened, but to show that a non-Islamic state is doing this to a Muslim state, and all Muslims, he has already called them to rally around him. Even Osama, who hates Saddam and says he's an infidel, but when he goes up against us, he says we ought to rally to him, you see? And it is because of the religion. He says, the enemies of God are those who choose to live in the world or sphere of ignorance and disbelief separate from Islam. The world or sphere of Islam just conquer and rule over those of ignorance and disobedience, which is us. Now, it is the classical Islamic view of we and they, Dar al-Islam versus Dar al-Harb. Now listen to this last statement. The peace of the world cannot be secured until the peoples come under the rule and protection of Islam. End quote. Christianity is a religion with a worldwide mandate. We are to go into all the world and preach the gospel. We are to go to every nation and tell them about Christ and pray for their conversion. Islam has a world religion also. They have a world mandate. They are never designed by Muhammad to be in one locality. They are to spread Islam until the world comes under Islam and Allah, and they can do it by talking, or they can do it by jihad, but they must do it. It is very important to see that there is a clash between these two world religions, because we both have a mandate, and we are not faithful unless we go into all the world. But they are not faithful unless they ultimately bring everyone into Dar al-Islam, where the brothers are at peace. Well, let's pray. Lord, learning these things is